That's Booker T. Jones, also known as just plain Booker T, on his Hammond B3 organ with Green Onions, his 1962 hit that Rolling Stones has rated as one of the 500 greatest tunes of all time. Booker T, a multi-instrumentalist, composer, arranger, and producer, began his professional career at age 16 and co-wrote this tune while still in high school. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and just what the heck are they smoking down there in Washington, D.C.? I just can't understand this. For the life of me, I just can't understand this. This seems relatively easy. You know, I think it's relatively easy as governments go and how they operate. You know, you have one group that is favoring A and the other group favoring B. And we have instead here in the United States an admixture of a whole bunch of things that may or may not have anything to do with the issue at hand of actually legislating. So we saw last night President Trump boasting of the significant victory won yesterday, he said, in the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Of course, you know about the vote. The vote was not to repeal or replace Obamacare, although that's what he indicated in Youngstown, Ohio, where he had a kind of rally, a campaign-style rally, to make note of these incredible strides that he has made since taking office. The vote actually was a vote to proceed, whether to proceed with further discussions on various pieces of legislation that are just sitting there, even though the Republicans are hell-bent on just repealing and replacing Obamacare. They'd said that a long time ago. Trump campaigned and made that a pivotal part of his appeal to his constituency, repealing and replacing Obamacare. So it's not like this thing popped up yesterday and, you know, snuck up and bit everybody in the butt. They knew that this was a high agenda item for them. And the best that they were able to do, because they actually got to the point of a tie vote with Vice President Pence having to cast to break the dead even vote. And that's how the Republicans, quote, won that vote yesterday. So Trump is kind of misrepresenting what happened. He figures, I suppose, being in Ohio, there is the flow of information stops at the border. But that's really what it was, that there was a dead even vote. And that's where I'm going today, because I can't make sense of what these people are doing. They're voting on this piece, but they don't like that piece. They're voting, they now have, according to the terms of the last vote, they have 20 hours to debate whatever it is they want to pass as the basis of the opposition to the Obamacare. So that's what they're working on now. But here's the thing. Nobody knows what's going on. They're acting like, you know, this is procedure, and they're just following procedure because they're an orderly group. And they, of course, Trump had yelled at them and made fun of them and derided them and kicked their butts publicly about the fact that they've been yammering about Obamacare and the need to replace and repeal it. Well, first you repeal it and then replace it. And it's now going on 7 years. I've talked about this before. You've been bellyaching for 7 years. And you don't have a plan of your own. There is no plan. And yet they're taking a vote to discuss very serious details of the Obamacare plan that they want thrown out. Nobody seems to know what the heck is going on in Washington, D.C. But I did say some time ago, and I repeated it yesterday, there is no plan. There is no alternative plan. You're mad at Obamacare? Fine. Where is your plan? What are you proposing? What's on the table from your side of the net? We don't have anything. Well, when will you be ready? We don't know. So they don't know when they're going to be ready. They don't have a plan. But they are absolutely sure that Obamacare should be repealed and replaced. Bizarre way to legislate, I would say. But, you know, this is America, and this passes for the norm. So I guess they will hash it out some more. They have a couple more days to go to play this silly game of we don't know when we'll be ready. We don't have a plan now, but we know for sure we don't like Obamacare. Now, what kind of a position is that? It's ridiculous. So we'll follow what's going on there and see if it gets any less weird. And we can find some kind of clarity in what it is they really, really want. And then comes another set of debating and voting on whatever it is they have to hash out among themselves to figure out what it is they really want. What are they asking for? They haven't, all these years have passed, and they haven't developed a cogent plan. And they expect people to believe that they have some common sense, that they're smart individuals. A whole bunch of them are lawyers. You would think that at the very least, you ought to have a plan. But then, as we have noted here so many times, they inherited that trait now from Donald Trump. Donald Trump never has a plan. He has no written down plan about anything. And yet these are vital issues. So I think that is a shame. I think it is an embarrassment. And I think people need to just tell them, you know, why then do we have to have a Senate? Why do we need to have a House? People in the House and Senate don't seem to be able to handle the responsibilities of legislating. They can't seem to get it together. And people are just waiting. Because they strongly believe the ball is going to drop out of the sky somewhere, and it is aimed directly at their heads. Without warning, this is exactly what is going to happen. A plan will appear from the heavens and will be dropped on our heads, and then we'll have to stop everything and deal with whatever it is they shove at us, and that will be the plan. So we'll see when they intend to end this charade and act like sensible people and responsible people who have a clue about how legislating ought to be done and who have some kind of an idea that they can get it done that way, and not to this haphazard, ridiculous charade day in, day out. Things are changing by the minute. We don't know where the heck things are going or where they're going. But I'm telling you, as we've been talking here, you better know where you're going. That's your homework. To begin to fashion your own plan for survival. These folks are not into that. They are not holding themselves responsible for our survival at all. Their survival is reasonably assured, but we are still sitting around waiting for these folks to develop some kind of disciplined way of working, and with the consciousness that so much is hanging in the balance that they ought to get it together. There's no incentive except Trump screaming at them and embarrassing them publicly into action. And even so, it's not working very well. One note before we move on about the vote. That dead even vote yesterday, which had to be broken with a vote by Vice President Pence, I thought about it, and I think there is a message here that we shouldn't ignore. The message is that many people in the Congress and the U.S. Senate and the House and Senate are deeply offended by the way this president is doing business. It has been a serious turnoff, and it has been a demoralizer. I'm not trying to find excuses for them, but I understood this vote this way. It was a kind of silent signal that they really have problems with this president. And even though they wanted to fight Obama and, they wanted to repeal and replace Obamacare and all these things, notwithstanding, the fact is it seems to me that they don't have, they have no spirit. It's gone. They used to be fighters. You know, it used to be a bunch of really good fighters in the House and Senate. But you see the effect of constant shaming and barking and, just harassing people, calling them out in public. Donald Trump's behavior is absolutely bizarre. And this vote came to a dead heat because they're not concerned. They're not tied into this thing anymore. They've lost spirit. They don't care at this point, many of them. They're going through the motions, but their heart just isn't in it. And I think they were saying to the president yesterday that we'll stop here. This is what it is, but we're stopping here right now. And whatever we have to do beyond this point, we'll give that a shot. But there's no zeal You don't get a sense from the senators that they're in fine fighting form. They've been beaten down. It's a sad thing to see, but that's what I read from their actions and from their demeanors. They're not fully engaged here. They are, in my view, I think they feel like they have been rendered, they have been neutered, they have been rendered useless. And in any event, they don't like operating this way. Just a note, it may show up in other ways, but that's what I observed from the way they were acting and the dead heat vote, which fell to the senior members to try and figure out what to do. But many of them by then had checked out psychologically from the process. And I think it's something worth looking at. Well, we will move on to the subject at hand. But first, I will introduce our guest. You know him quite well. He's been on this program many times and singularly has walked us through the fine and infinite details of the Clinton Foundation and the shenanigans that have been going on there. And we have been discussing this phenomenon called the Clinton Foundation, which Charles Ortel calls the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history. He has been dealing in the last 2 years. He has been devoting his time specifically to doing forensic audits and doing very close examinations of the operations of the Clinton Foundation, and has emerged as the leading expert on the Clinton Foundation and how it has come to be a very interesting mix of a super funded foundation, and yet it doesn't show that it's making money. It doesn't show that it is engaging in unusual practices. It doesn't show that it even obeys the law. So that's what he's been doing and reporting to us regularly on new findings that he continues to unearth. Just to remind you who Charles Ortel is, he's not just connected to the world of charities, he's also connected to the world of defending charities that go the right way and taking dead aim at those that are operating under specious circumstances and skirting the law. The Clinton Foundation is one such charity. And I've been reporting as well on this. This is a major story because the Clinton Foundation's endeavors and the conduct of its principals are alarming, to say the least, bordering on criminal. And so there have been some developments, and we are here to hear them from Charles today. Thanks, Charles, for being with us.
It's my great pleasure, Yatrice. Thanks for having me back on.
Not at all. Very, very welcome here. You've been doing some more digging, therefore you've been doing some more discovering.
Indeed. So what's happened here is that apparently at the 7 o'clock hour this morning on Fox and Friends, Ainsley Earhart said that her sources tell her that Attorney General Sessions will indeed open a serious investigation into the Clinton Foundation. And by serious investigation, what one means is, you know, you could slow walk an investigation, which is my guess and suspicion what James Comey was doing, or you can convene a grand jury and use your subpoena powers to demand the types of information that, you know, people understand charity frauds would want to get immediately. And with that, if that is true, and I believe it is true, the Clintons' world just changed. It went from awful to worse than that. Because one of the reasons I was prepared to do this 2 years' work, or who knows how many more years it will take to get it across the line, but all this work, is that it is such a massive fraud over so many years, now 20 years in October, and it's by people who should know better. I mean, whether you dislike them or like them, you have to admit that the Clintons have credentials. I mean, he was a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Yale Law School. They met at Yale Law School. She was, you know, regularly on a list of the best lawyers in America. He is universally acclaimed as being a very smart person. So they can't claim as a defense we were ignorant of the essentials of charity law. And an important difference in this type of fraud from, say, Enron or one of these corporate frauds, in a corporate fraud, you have to prove something that's called, it's spelled S-C-I-E-N-T-E-R, scienter. And what it means is that you had no knowledge and that you intended to cause harm. You have to prove that in a corporate fraud. That requirement is specifically lifted from laws that apply in the United States and around the world to charities, because in charities, you're not supposed to have any for-profit motive. So it is much easier to prove charity fraud. All you have to prove is that the papers that are in the public domain, and mind you, this is supposedly a public charity, that is to say, it solicits from the public while we're on this interview. They are raising money right now using the internet. They're soliciting. And you are not allowed to solicit while filings that are before the states and the IRS and foreign governments contain false and materially misleading statements and omit material statements. You're just not allowed to do it. And that's why prior to December 16th, 2015, that's why I put up on my site, I strongly advise you to stop soliciting, because, you know, as long as you solicit, each request for money, and Bill himself has been on with Barbara Streisand recently, you know, jointly asking for more money. Every single request is a felony count of solicitation fraud. Each request. And as our, which is not really a friend, but as Corinne Brown, we've talked about her, the representative, former representative in the House of Representatives, as she understands bitterly now, small solicitation frauds, 800,000 in her case, it's alleged, result in gigantic prison terms. We'll see how much of a prison term she gets. I mean, I think she's 7 years old. She served in Congress for more than 20 years. She's an African-American Democrat who was prosecuted, I believe, starting in June, July period last year in the middle of an election campaign. So, you know, the world should be asking, you know, in much the same way as it's, you know, I think it's unfair that, you know, a recreational cocaine use by, you know, affluent white people in the suburbs, well, that gets a light sentence, but crack cocaine, you go away forever. I mean, this is a sort of the same idea in charity fraud. I mean, Corinne does an $800,000 charity fraud. She gets sent up the river to federal prison. We don't know yet for how long, but at one point they were saying she could be sent away for 350 years for $800,000. And the Clintons are living in at least two mansions that we know of, one in Chappaqua, one in Washington, D.C., jetting around the world on private planes, getting these huge book advances and speaking fees. Not a care in the world. It just doesn't seem right. And but anyway, if it is true, as Ainsley Earhart reported, that indeed the resources of the Attorney General and the full Justice Department are going to be brought to bear upon the Clinton public filings, the real question here is not how big is the fraud. The real question is, what was James Comey actually doing, if anything, between December 2001 and the mid-year 2005, when he was involved first as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, leading personally an investigation and issuing subpoenas in his name to get material for the Clinton Foundation? What was he? We know what he was looking at, because on the FBI vault file, Google that, and put in Clinton Foundation, you'll get over 600 pages in two separate dumps that tells you they were looking at public corruption, they were looking at abuse of the Federal Election Commission reporting system, they were looking at lying under oath, corruptly influencing investigation, and one other crime, federal crimes all. You know, and they had the resources back then. They had convened at least one grand jury. They claim in the meeting notes that are not redacted that they had a special war room. They were cooperating between Chappaqua and New York and Washington, D.C. They were trying to get information from Bern, Switzerland. What was that all about? There's a NASA file in the FBI records that, you know, in a heartbeat, you should be able to go back to 2001 to 2005 and say, what did we already get? And then look at the rules that pertain to foundations in those years and understand that in New York, the law in New York that was passed in 1993, so it plainly applied to the Clinton Foundation, required entities that were registered inside New York, and this foundation registered in June of 1998, first time in New York, to solicit from New York addresses, are absolutely required to get consolidated, which means not sloppy, partial, you know, third grade level baloney accounts, but I love baloney, by the way, but real accounts that are fully compliant with what are called generally accepted accounting standards or principles, depending on how you look at it. And these require that you look precisely and consistently at the real results of all the Clinton Foundation activities around the world, eliminate any inter-charity transactions, fully disclose any related party dealings, which could involve, you know, corrupt acts. You've got to disclose all of that. And yet, for the period October 23 to 1997 to December 31, 1997, there's no information provided, even though they were, in fact, active, and even though they obviously ran up expenses at the law firm Williams & Connolly and their Arkansas law firm putting a package together to file with the IRS. And who knows, they should have filed in Arkansas, but there's no proof they did. There's no records for 97, and there are no audits that are legally compliant for any year through 2004, which is precisely when they built their Little Rock complex. And you tell me, you know, is this the same team that interviewed the Sarnaev brothers? You know, they couldn't find anything wrong before they blew up the Boston Marathon? I mean, what were these people doing between 2001 and 2004, you know, five? I mean, we have some really serious line agents at the FBI who understand accounting. They understand charity fraud. What were they doing? And if they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, who was overseeing these people? Who caused the investigation to stand down without any prosecutions? It's a travesty of justice. And then,
well, we now have a complication here. And the complication is the ever-changing cast. The ever-changing prosecutorial cast, and they began sinking early under what would seem to be the dead weight of corruption and patronage within the government itself. Starting with Holder. I don't know if you count him as being very important to possible investigation of Hillary Clinton, but we could start there. You have Mueller. You have Sessions, and we see what has happened. Do you expect that this would be a major hindrance in getting anywhere close to a prosecution? Because in one way or the other, the prosecutors or would-be prosecutors were sidelined by a whole bunch of things verging on criminal activity. And in the case of Sessions, Trump has been riding this man over this specific issue. How come Sessions isn't moving fast enough to prosecute Hillary Clinton? But maybe he's a coward. You know, this is what is going on now.
See, where I believe President Trump's making a mistake is he should not say this is about Hillary Clinton, because indeed it isn't. What it's about is a network of charity frauds that goes well beyond the Democrats to Republicans, the members of, we call them rhinos, Republicans in name only. And, you know, this is a fraud that flourished under George W. Bush. It's a fraud that had its base in Massachusetts, has its base in Massachusetts, and operated right under the nose of Governor Romney, a Republican, when he was governor. I mean, this fraud has been ongoing and really metastasized just after whoever was in charge dropped the investigation. Believe it or not, on the 18th of November, 2004, there's several memos that suggest that was the date that they decided to wind it down. That was the date they opened the Little Rock facility. That was the date the Clintons defrauded the people by turning over a crooked foundation that was illegally organized, illegally operated since inception, not in compliance with laws, and therefore it broke the statute, specific terms of the statute, which called for a validly organized foundation to make the partial grant that they made of the right to use a portion of the Little Rock facility to the National Archives. What they did is they broke that statute, and they did so knowingly. They've been trying to hide an agreement we've got now, in people looking at this, which is called the Joint Use and Operating Agreement of that facility. And it was signed on the 17th and 18th of November 2004, and came into effect on the 18th of 2004. And in that document, which is carefully crafted on behalf of We the People, there's a specific stipulation, several of them, but there's one important one that says every representation made by the Clinton Foundation is true and correct and will be true and correct through the life of the agreement. And that was absolutely untrue on the date we took possession of that facility. So it has been a fraud since then, actually since before then. And the problem here, Utrice and our listeners, is that it's not only Mueller who's implicated in this. It's not only Comey who's implicated in this, but it's Rod Rosenstein as well, the Deputy Attorney General. Because a key piece of this fraud has been the illegal claims that they are, quote, fighting HIV/AIDS internationally, as if that's a charitable purpose. It is not a charitable purpose. They knew it wasn't a charitable purpose. And more to the point, they didn't control this. And these illegally manufactured drugs that were not controlled properly in places like India and were sent around the world under the control of the Clinton, in quotes, Foundation, but really under the control of Bill Clinton and Ira Magaziner personally. One key vendor of these drugs is a company called Ranbaxy, that frankly the previous owners of Ranbaxy should be hunted down and put in the worst prison on earth, wherever that may be, maybe in Djibouti or something like that. Because these people, you know, going way back, they operated this Ranbaxy company, which was a large company. It had about 50% of its revenues in 2003 were inside the United States. They were exporting drugs, generic drugs, not AIDS drugs, but other drugs into the United States market, and they had never tested validly any of their drugs. They had fake laboratories and, you know, pretending they tested things and manufacturing. They had actual operations that could make reports look old. So they type reports up and they put them in a special gadget that would age a piece of paper and make it seem as if they retroactively had something. That entity reached an agreement with the Clinton Foundation, with Bill Clinton and Ira Magaziner, to promote the sale of Ranbaxy products around the world, but they didn't disclose that to the charity regulators. You're not allowed to do that. The charity's not to be, you're not allowed to, you know, engage in this type of for-profit activity, and it's also not allowed to work for what's called a foreign principle. A foreign principle, the press was making a lot about Manafort and his alleged ties to Russia and maybe working as a foreign agent without registering. The real issue here is that if you work either for a foreign government, you can't do that without registering. But you also can't work for a foreign business controlled. And this business was controlled by Indian nationals for certain. You cannot do that without registering. And, you know, they were very helpful. My suspicion is that Bill Clinton, through his network of contacts at the FDA, was very helpful in forestalling a real investigation of not just Ranbaxy, but some of the other crooked vendors. There's a company called Hetero. There's a company called Matrix Laboratories, which was bought by Mylan. Aspen Healthcare in South Africa. A bunch of the vendors to the Clinton Foundation had serious problems with fraud. And Rod Rosenstein his office was in charge of an investigation that I don't understand why it took so long. the FBI raided Ranbaxy's offices, certain offices in the United States in 2016, on Valentine's Day. And it took until May 13th, 2013, 7 years later, seven plus years later, to craft a settlement which resulted in $500 million of penalties being assessed against Ranbaxy. But I think that was too light. So, you know, Rosenstein was centrally involved. His name is the main name on the settlement. You know, he was in the office as U.S. attorney in Baltimore for a long time before he took his present role. In Baltimore, we have that issue. We have the issue of Laureate, which I would argue illegally enriched the Clintons while Hillary was serving as Secretary of State without disclosing the terms of the five-year contract that Bill Clinton got starting in the April-May timeframe in 2010. Laureate is based in Baltimore and would be under the purview of then U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein. That transaction, the leveraged buyout transaction of Laureate, which started in 2006 and closed in 2007, I think it's fraught with problems. I think the operation of Laureate, the public disclosures of Laureate are fraught with problems. And, you know, he missed that. And he also missed the Bush-Clinton-Haiti Fund, which was formed in January 2010 without properly disclosing their failed ventures in disaster relief, criminal operations of disaster relief efforts starting in India in January 2001, moving to the tsunami in 2005 early, moving on to the Gulf Coast Recovery Fund, and then omitted Katrina in 2005. They disclosed none of the flaws in their reporting in all of those ventures in an application to the IRS in January 2010. And then they report that the Clinton Foundation, the parent, reports that it granted $37.2 million, the largest single item, expense item, on their financial statement. So it was highly material. They claim they sent it to a post office box in Maryland, which where the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund was never registered. And Rosenstein missed that in 2011 when they filed the forms, and he missed it again in November 2015 when the Clinton Foundation refiled their 2010 filing without correcting that mistake. So, you know, I have serious questions about Rosenstein. I have serious questions about Mueller. It's been reported that Mueller was involved possibly in the Uranium One transaction, or at least in uranium projects involving America and Russia. You know, if that is the case, if he had anything to do with the Clinton-Justra and Uranium One matter that happened in starting in 2005, 6, 7 timeframe, he had anything to do with that. He has a clear conflict here in any investigation of the Clinton Foundation. I think Rosenstein has a conflict, and I think Comey definitely has a conflict. I think each of those three people could actually be targets of new investigations, and therefore they should be standing down from the, you know, supposed investigation into Russian interference. Now, on that thing, which is, I'll just make a, if I may, Utrecht, a brief comment on that. I'm one of the people who believes that the American public definitely deserves a far-reaching public investigation, joint investigation of the House and the Senate into what really happened in 2016. In the last 48 hours, we've learned of the arrest of somebody who was trying to flee the country. This person from Pakistan was stand with the last name A-W-A-N. There's an intrepid group of citizen journalists, a man named George Webb and Jason Goodman and Trish Negron, who's a woman, who've done yeoman's duty early on, working also with our good friends at the Daily Caller Foundation, to expose the degree to which this Awan person and his siblings and family were on contract, making millions of dollars, providing information technology services to Debbie Wasserman Schultz without being properly vetted or, you know, any of these details disclosed to the regulators. Now, what was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairman of the DNC, doing employing a firm of Pakistani IT professionals, and who knows what information they got off of her computer and off the DNC computer? I mean, there needs to be a real investigation into that. There needs to be, for the benefit of the Bernie friends out there, I think, I'll say this as an independent, formerly a conservative Republican, I think Bernie Sanders was robbed in the Democratic primary. I do not think he got a fair deal in numerous states. Nevada, you know, New York, here in Williamsburg and other places, I think he was robbed. And I think, you know, we need to have visibility into what really happened in that primary for the Democrats. I think it's clear, you know, that Trump, you know, had an upset victory against 16 established members of the Republican Party. want to investigate those primaries, by all means, do that too. And let's get into the general election. And let's consider that it may not have been only Russian meddling. What if China meddles? What if friendly powers meddle? I mean, after all, Barack Obama apparently tapped, or his administration tapped into Angela Merkel's cell phone. So, I mean, we were involved, I believe, our country, and I don't think it's a good thing. We were involved meddling in the discussions of the British exit from the EU. We were involved in the Israeli election meddling. Barack Obama heavily intervened, made it known that he's not want to see Bibi Netanyahu reelected. I believe we intervened in many foreign elections, and the American people have a right to know about that. You know, we can't throw stones from glass houses. If we're going to castigate foreign countries for investigating in our election, we better not be meddling in foreign people's elections. And, you know, we got to stop this. So I'm all for having a real investigation. I'm not against, you know, going there. And if it turns out that unbeknownst to Trump or known to Trump, people in his campaign were under the thrall of any foreign government, Russian or otherwise, that's a very serious matter, and we deserve to know. But if, on the other hand, he wasn't, you know, then he should be cleared. And let's move on, and let's get to the serious business you were talking about, of actually forget about Obamacare. It's not care. You know, it's an insurance scheme that is a fraudulent insurance scheme. It doesn't work. You know, let's bring down the cost of health care for all Americans. It's high time we did that. And let's, you know, stop wasting resources chasing a shadow. Anyway, I think
Who's going to do that piece of the work? Because it seems as if everybody who could have begun it, for some reason or the other, was sidelined. Now we have the possibilities being reported that Sessions, fully anticipating that Trump will fire him for whatever reason, and Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor of the city of New York and a former federal prosecutor, is waiting in the wings, supposedly to pick up from where his predecessors left off. Is that going to help or hurt things?
Well, so my understanding is that Giuliani has already come out saying he's not aware of this, and if he were going to be replacing Sessions, you have to go through a very serious vetting process, especially to be our nation's top legal officer below the president, who actually technically the president is the top legal officer. But so my own personal view on this, you and your audience may not like this much, I'm all for putting the man with the funny haircut into the attorney general. That would be that's Trey Gowdy. Talk about a tough prosecutor. He is a relentless and objective, actually, fair-minded and objective prosecutor whose, you know, hairstylist is, I don't know from what planet that person from. And I speak as a follically challenged American. and I say that as a follically challenged American. But, I think, what we know, we've talked about this before, we know from Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller's reporting and Mark Tapscott, his colleague there, we know that supposedly FBI field offices, as many as four, have been investigating this since late last year. And we know also through a public release that the IRS has had an open investigation in the Dallas office since last year. So, you know, changing horses with Sessions, the whole idea of the way our system works is that, you know, when the top cop or second top, what do you want to call him, is replaced, the wheels of justice grind on. We have supposedly decent, fair-minded career members in our Justice Department who are supposed to be apolitical. One wonders just how apolitical these people might be, because many of them were appointed by the Clintons way back when. So, we should be able to run this investigation, and I only know a very limited number of FBI people, not in connection with this Clinton stuff, but just through personal life. And those whom I've met are just stellar human beings. I mean, they are they're not people you want to get in trouble with, but they're very, very fact-oriented, law-oriented. Is this, what are the facts? What are the relevant laws? Do the facts suggest that laws are broken? If they were broken, is it a significant matter that, you know, where the American public would be better off exposing it and bringing these people to justice so we teach the wider world a lesson about how our laws work? Or is this a trivial case? Is it a central case? What is it? And they weigh and do these kind of things very matter-of-factly, very thoroughly, very professionally. And so I have the utmost confidence in the line members of the Federal Bureau. It's not the Federal Bureau of Matters, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I have utmost confidence in these people. I would bet they have been chafing at the bit to get to the root cause of this. I mean, after all, we had, I generally do not watch 60 Minutes, but on Sunday nights these days, there's precious little to watch. And so I happened to be watching it last Sunday, this past Sunday, and they had a segment on about this Governor McDonnell, former governor in Virginia, who was convicted, and I forget if he served time in prison or not, but he was convicted over a $160,000 public corruption case that caused a furor. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States overturned the conviction and freed him. And the guy who was responsible for prosecuting was this guy, Jim Cole, who was, I think, a senior member of the Clinton White House legal team. And then he was actually, believe it or not, put in to be the special master or special person overseeing that insurance giant, AIG, which blew up to the cost of who knows how much money to all we taxpayers. He missed that fraud. And then he went in, and he, I think, had Rosenstein's position for a time under Eric Holder, who I would say flat out, he was cited for contempt by Congress. He was centrally involved in the Markrich pardon. He tries to claim that it happened without his real knowledge. I don't think that was the case. I don't think that could have been the case. That was central to the Clinton Foundation fraud. That was central to the Clinton Foundation investigation that ran from 2001 to 2004. So Jim Cole is somebody I would be marking for suspicion. And here's a guy he takes on and wins temporarily a conviction and the several appeals against a former, I think, Republican governor in Virginia. Yet we have this guy McCabe as the acting director of the FBI whose wife took money from Terry McAuliffe. Man, it's ridiculous. And McAuliffe is centrally a figure in this Clinton Foundation fraud. He was a trustee of the Clinton Foundation in key moments while he had provided financial assistance to the Clinton family to get their mansion, in their first mansion in Washington, D.C., in Chappaqua. So he didn't disclose any of that in the Clinton Foundation filings, as he should have done and as the Clinton should have done.
Let me just announce, if people want to talk with you, Charles, 888-874-4888 is the number to call to talk with Charles or tell. Continue.
So, you know, there's a lot to talk about here. There's a lot the American people will be horrified to learn. It's high time that these people at the FBI be given the license to let the forensic team at the FBI look at the evidence again that they had gotten in 2001 to 4, look through the file, figure out who, if anybody, may have obstructed the real investigation into the Clinton Foundation. And, you know, get back into the papers. What really happened? How much did that Little Rock complex actually cost? You know, I won't bore you with the pesky details, but having spent some time uncovering a very complex, what I believe to be, set of frauds at General Electric, which is a far bigger entity. General Electric, when I started on it, had a market capitalization that the value of its debt and equity was $900 billion. Clinton Foundation declared financial statements for its entire life for slightly more than $2 billion. So it's a peanut compared to the massive DE mess, which had, you know, many millions of pages, frankly, of filing. I didn't look at millions, but I looked at many, many pages. In the Clinton Foundations, you can go in and you can reconstruct what they originally said. They have tried to hide their original filings. I found them. They're online in the state of Massachusetts, in the state of New York, and in the state of California. You can get these missing, in quotes, audits for 2003 and 4. And if you understand elementary accounting, it's not, you know, you don't have to have a PhD in accounting or even be a certified public accountant. You just understand that every set of financial statements needs to have an income statement, a balance sheet, and a cash flow statement. An income statement tells you how much money you earned and how much money you spent. A balance sheet tells you the value of the enterprise on a given date. And a cash flow statement tells you not what you earned or spent, but what happened to your cash. And you need for these type of foundations were required to have all three sets of financial statements prepared consistently. That means you can't look at, you know, the foundation one way in 2004 and a different way in 2005. You got to do the financial statements on the same consistent basis year by year. And you've got to have informative footnotes that explain any material fact that is, you know, that is worth somebody knowing about. And they hid these financial statements, which I found, that say flatly on them, in the actual introduction to the financial statements, these financial statements are not prepared in accordance with U.S. law, basically at the request of the trustees. That is gross negligence to do that, to have financial statements hidden from the public while you're fundraising that the trustees expressly direct the accounting firm to prepare, not in compliance with U.S. law. An idiot who knows nothing about accounting can figure out right away that that's a fraud. You're not allowed to do that. So when you go and you do a little bit of forensic work and you look at what they initially said was the condition of the foundation, and then in 2006 they cooked the books retroactively back to 2004 and prepared a different basis of financial statements. And when you do that, the reason I believe they reconstructed all, the reason they did all that was to hide the diversion of between 64 and 80 million U.S. dollars. Now, that's a lot of money on a balance sheet of like $120, $150 million. The massive diversion in 2004. Now, let's see what happened in 2004 and 2006. 2004, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, there was a presidential election, and both parties needed money. And the chairman of the Democratic Party, who was that in 2004? Oh, it was Terry McAuliffe. He was one of the trustees, the four trustees of the Clinton Foundation in 2004, when $60 to $80 million seems to have been diverted from the books, and when three loans were obtained fraudulently on false and materially misleading documentation across state lines in two cases. That's a very serious offense. Set of offense. 2006, I don't know, somebody in the Senate who was thinking about maybe running for president needed money to run her reelection campaign in 2006. Might that have been Hillary Clinton?
It could have been.
And it just might have been. And, you know, are the financial statements for 2004, 5, and 6 a mess? Do they obscure massive diversions, possibly from a large foreign entity called Unitaid, which is an international organization that has been corruptly run since inception, in my view, on September 19th, 2006 forward? You know, is there a report in French? I am asking rhetorical questions here. Is there a report in French by a court called the COUR, C-O-U-R-S, and then new word D-E, and then new word C-O-M-P-E-S, Cour de Compte? What that is a special court in France that has the jurisdiction and purview of, we should have such a court, frankly, of going into the finances of the government of France to figure out whether monies spent on behalf of the people of France by their government were misused. And a report was done, commissioned starting in December of 2009, into what may have happened with large sums of money. By the end of 2009, this report claims, you know, I've used Google Translate, I remember my schoolboy French, so I can, you know, quickly get to the gist of it, that the Clinton Foundation had received or had gotten advances against future revenues, which is very unusual. Most foundations do not allow recipients to get advances against future year activity. But by year-end 2009, on December 31st, 2009, the very day that Bill Clinton himself, his name is on this, Ira Magaziner's name is on this, some very famous people's names are in an application before the IRS to create a new entity called Clinton Health Access Initiative, and that application has to be true and truthful and complete. It contains numerous material omissions. It does not. It falsely claims that this new thing, Clinton Health Access Initiative, was not taking over the activities of any other organization, when it's obvious that it was taking over the activities of the illegally organized Clinton HIV/AIDS initiative, which was by far and away the biggest piece of the Clinton Foundation in 2009. And this French report says that as of December 31st, 2009, the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS initiative had received cash and advances totaling more than $450 million. And yet Bill Clinton's name is on an application saying, no, no, this is a new thing. We have no previous activities. And this sails through the IRS. This application that was tendered December 31st, 2009, is approved by the IRS on March 15th, 2010. And guess who was in charge of the department that approved this? Lois Lerner.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today because we're out of time. But this thing keeps swirling around and around and around, but doesn't seem to be going forward. And that's the big question now. Why, after so much has been documented that would cause any government or any functionary with this kind of responsibility in the government to begin to do something, that it has gone on undetected, unpunished, uninvestigated for so long. But we'll continue the discussion. Thanks, Charles, for being with us again, once again, bringing our attention to this. This is a very serious matter that is being deliberately covered up and ignored. But thank you for being with us. We'll talk again soon.
Stay tuned.
Coming up next, the Intelligence Hour with Kevin Shipp. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.